Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we are back. Finally, with part three of our series on childhood amnesia. We had a bit of an interruption in the series last week due, first of all, to some sick days and then to a scheduled interview, but now we return to finish off the series. So I thought we should do a brief refresher on the stuff we talked about in the past couple of episodes here. So the term childhood amnesia refers to a couple of different facts, which are, first of all, the fact that most adults cannot conjure any genuine firsthand episodic memories from before roughly the age of three. And there are some minor variations in that age horizon that have been observed to correlate with variables like gender. Girls tend to have slightly earlier memories, culture. Different cultures have, on average, different memory horizons. But on average, we can say most people's earliest memories tend to be somewhere in the range of 3 years old or between three or four. And then the other fact is that once we do start having memories, for the next 4 to 5 years after that, we have fewer memories than would be predicted by the normal rate of forgetting that holds true throughout the rest of your life. So first you got no memories usually, and then you've got fewer memories, and then finally the regular rate of forgetting kicks in, maybe somewhere around 7 or 8 or so. Now, some people do claim to have much earlier memories, and we've heard from some of them in email. Some people claim to have memories even up to and before birth. And, you know, it's impossible to rule that out. It's possible in some cases people do have those memories, but these claims also have to be considered alongside the fact that research shows it is very easy to create the false impression of a childhood memory spurred by all kinds of external prompting, anything from a photo, whether a real photo or a doctored one, a story told by a parent. And it's clear that these false memories implanted later in life, in many cases, feel completely genuine to us, even if they are fabricated purely for the purpose of an experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. So we want to continue to drive that home, that to whatever extent a memory is accurate, augmented, fabricated, etc., that doesn't take away from the subjective reality of the memory, the importance of the memory, or the pain of the memory.
Well, sure. Yeah, one of the ways I would put it is that, like, the fact that someone has a false memory, as in they have a memory of an event that did not actually happen, does not mean that they're, like, lying. It, you know, like, we literally cannot tell the difference between real memories and false memories in many cases.
Right. And I think it's safe to say that the many memories, if not all memories, are false to some degree.
Right. Now, in previous parts, we also talked about some of the experimental methods used to test for memory at early ages, including, you know, straightforward earliest memory prompts. Tell me your earliest memory. Things like the word cue test. So tell me a memory associated with the following word. We use the example of jar and so forth. Now, some research we discussed in previous episodes made a pretty convincing case, at least to me, that the explanation is not that the brain is incapable of forming memories before the average age of 3 or 4. One of the other studies we talked about included a scenario in which 3-year-olds could produce details about recent events in their lives when interviewed along with their mothers, showing that they did have memories of recent things that had happened. And these memories could be elicited with cues from parents, though it seems in a lot of cases, children this young will not offer details from memory spontaneously. But if you kind of coax it out of them, they can produce details on their own that show they do remember things.
Yeah, plus if mom is there to help, you know.
Right. But when those very same kids were interviewed years later, after having been able to produce memories about recent events at age 3, between the ages of 7 and 9, many of those memories of early events were lost. And a lot more were lost by the ages of 8 and 9 than were lost by the age of 7. So there appears to be in later childhood kind of a period of rapid, massive forgetting, where a lot of our earliest memories kind of vanish like memories of a dream. So the big question is, why? Why is it that many of these earliest memories, or what memories exist of earliest events, cannot be produced later in life, either later in childhood or especially in adulthood? There have been a lot of attempts to answer this question. There, of course, is still a lot of controversy about it. It is not a settled debate. But many of the proposed answers are based in the developing structure of the brain. And while I think there is absolutely something to these arguments, the neurodevelopmental structural arguments, they don't exactly mean that the immature brain cannot make memories yet. Because again, as we've seen, sometimes you can get younger children to provide details about recent events. And also young children can show examples of learning, say learning how to manipulate a simple mechanism in a toy in experiments that show that they do have memories that in some cases last for weeks or months, even before the age of 3. So there is some remembering going on. Instead, it seems to me more likely that what's happening here is the memories that the brain makes at age 1 or 2 are prone to more rapid forgetting than the kinds of memories we would make at age 11 or 12. Or also, those memories might be different than the memories made in later life in a way that makes them more difficult to retrieve after we age past that memory horizon. So for the neurodevelopmental structural arguments, we looked at one paper in part 2 arguing that the hippocampal memory system is actually very active in the first few years of life. That's the normal memory system. A lot is going on there when you're, you know, 2 years old or so. But this paper argued that instead of making memories of the kind that will be stored for the rest of your life, what it's primarily doing with the processing of information from experiences is learning how to learn. And complementary to this, I think one structural developmental explanation that's been offered is that a lot of early autobiographical memories may be lost due to the rapid rate of neurogenesis during childhood. So as new brain cells are formed, especially in the hippocampus, this may erode the stability of the structural basis of existing memories. So, you know, the hippocampus is developing rapidly. You're sort of like, you know, rebuilding the house constantly in real time, in which case the rooms that existed, you know, a year ago might not really exist anymore as rooms down the road.
It's almost heartbreaking to think about that with childhood memories.
Yeah. But like the house is getting bigger, you know, you can put more in it, but you're also dismantling as you do.
Yeah, and I guess it's like thinking of it in terms of the young child. It's like the house that is being built is going to be magnificent as well, and it's built on the bones of the house that came before. So you can't get too sentimental about that which is being lost as a necessary part of the child's maturing. But I still reserve the right to cry a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you recall, I got interested in this whole idea because of a story about my daughter, who is actually, I said 5 months last time, you know, she's coming up on 6 months now. Wow. And we were trying to figure out, okay, so we've been really making her laugh a lot by dropping a cloth on her face. She thinks this is hilarious. Mm-hmm. Just lay her down on the blanket and drop the cloth from above. And we were like, is she going to remember that she thought this was funny? Will she be able to explain why she thought it was funny when she's older? And unfortunately, it breaks my heart. I think the answer is probably not.
Still, these are prime years to just kill it as a dad stand up.
Yeah.
So just keep developing that material.
But anyway, so while the overall causes of childhood amnesia are still being debated in the scientific literature, I'm very won over that at least one of the major causes probably is the neurodevelopmental issue we talked about in the last episode with the hippocampus coming online. And developing, of course, it also seems plausible that it's a phenomenon with multiple contributing causes. And maybe some are based not just in the physical development of the brain, but possibly in some more externally visible developmental milestones, maybe based in the environment and things we learn. And so I thought before we move away from this topic, we should explore a few of those ideas as well. So another factor I've read about linked to childhood amnesia, possibly explaining elements of it, is language. This seems like an obvious place to go. The language and the linguistic environment in which a child grows up. What if the extent to which we record experiences as memories and the form in which they're stored and our later ability to retrieve and make sense of those memories is in some way dependent on language? The typical childhood memory horizon tends to come pretty much right in the middle of a period of rapid development of language skills and the acquisition of vocabulary. So could it be that the adult capacity for memory greatly depends on the use of words and concepts that we gain during this language acquisition period? Could be coincidence, but developing skills and manipulating different types of subjects and predicates, I think, could play a role in the onset of autobiographical memories that persist over time. Because language obviously plays a major role in how we as adults remember and tell autobiographical memories. Like, you ever notice how when you tell a story from memory, you often end up using the same or similar words to do so? Why is that? I mean, even if so, you can understand how if you are like reporting speech in a memory, you would want to use the same words to do so because you're reporting what somebody said. But say you're reporting a nonverbal event, just like a walk you went on and things you saw. Very often you use the same or similar words to do so, or at least I think I do. And most people I notice seem to do. Would this be your experience also?
Yeah. And I do. It kind of brings me back to the topic of dad, stand-up comedian. Because I wonder, like, to a large extent, it's like you keep retelling a story more or less the same way because you know what's really working. You know, yeah. Like, what what makes it more dramatic, what makes it more funny, which, how you can frame it in a way that also brings to mind, like, scenes from movies or something. So, I think there's a lot of that going on.
Oh, well, it's interesting you bring up the role of entertainment in the language used to relate a memory. That'll come up again in just a minute. But I think I would acknowledge that certain types of vocabulary might actually make the difference between the ability to coherently remember an event and recall it years later versus the characteristics that often come up when people are describing their very earliest memories, even the ones we've heard of from listeners in the email we got after the first couple of parts, like the kind of rare, fragmented, decontextualized sensory memories that people often produce as their very earliest. Those have a very different character than a lot of later memories. And that may, it seems to me like those differences could correlate with not really having the language to organize them as memories at the time they're formed. But if language does play an important role in establishing the capacity for long-term memories about your life, what if it's not just conceptual vocabulary? Another way language could have something to do with memory in early childhood is narrative. So when you are asked to explain a memory from childhood, for example, what's the first time you can remember swimming in the ocean? You could say, I was in Florida, I was about three. Or you could say, well, I was with my mom and dad, and we were in Florida, and the sand was white. And I remember I saw a crab, and it scared me. But my dad told me it was safe, and the crab wouldn't chase me. And then the water was cold. It was colder than the bath. And then salt water got in my nose. And I didn't like that at first, but then I did. And then later we went to dinner at a restaurant, and my dad got steamed crabs. And he remembered the crab on the beach, and he kept teasing me. He made the crab creep up on me on the table.
Oh, is this an actual memory for you?
No, I just made it up, but it seems like it could be.
Because, I mean, you do have a certain fascination with crabs. So if this were a legitimate memory, perhaps, Joe, perhaps we're retrieving this memory through the exercise of podcasting.
This explains everything. It's how I got Corman brain, and now it's just leaking out in a made-up story right here. But no, so at least in the way you tell stories from childhood, there is a wide range of stylistic flexibility. You could mention things in a dry, informational manner, reporting just where you were and what happened, or you could offer information more in the kind of narrative style that people enjoy and make meaning out of when they tell stories to each other. And you could call this distinction sort of reporting versus reminiscing, you know, with the storytelling being more social in nature and more entertainment focused, honestly. So that comes back to your thing about having a certain format of the memory that is based around the language you've found is best to express it for entertainment value or for communicating what you're trying to get across.
Yeah. And exaggeration, also, I find, is also a tool you often see employed. Sometimes, I guess at later ages, you see it used intentionally exaggerating the emotional context of an event in order to make a better story out of it. Though I've also seen much younger children do that. I remember, and this was like a birthday party I took my son to, and there's a slip and slide. Tensions were running high, I think. And and an adult went down the slip and slide, and then the birthday boy exclaimed, "This is a disaster," and seemed rather perturbed by the whole scenario. I don't know how that experience matured or stayed or stuck around as a memory, but like that kind of exaggeration, I can imagine, could make it, if it was truly viewed as a disaster, as a catastrophe of a non-child going down a slip and slide.
Well, just think about, if that child later tells that story, all the different ways that the story could be loaded. I mean, it could be loaded with like humor, sort of ironic reflection on how one feels as a child. Or I don't know, maybe if you mature a certain way, you might still take it very seriously and be upset about the slip and slide. But there's all this loading in stories that is not just merely reporting the facts about an event, but to make the facts reported make sense within some broader story. You might call this having the facts contexted. That's how it was expressed in the abstract of a paper I was looking at. But you also make evaluative statements and implications about those facts. So not just why happened, but I felt X about Y. Mm. And I've read numerous sources alleging that there could be a link between the narrative reminiscing style of, say, the family or the environment in which a child grows up and the age at which those children form lasting memories. I was reading about this in one article in the Berkeley Greater Good magazine by Gene Shinsky, and another article in the BBC from 2016 by Zaria Gorvit. These were essentially making the link that that some researchers think more elaborate, coherent narratives could cause children to have memories that last longer. And one example was cited in that BBC article. It was a paper done by the Cornell University psychology professor Chi Wang, who was the author of a paper called Culture Effects on Adults' Earliest Childhood Recollection and Self-Description, Implications for the Relation Between Memory and the Self, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology in 2001. And this found that by comparing childhood stories told by Chinese and American college students, American students' stories tended to be longer and more elaborate, with more self-focused evaluations, whereas the Chinese stories were more restrained and factual. And also, the average earliest memories of the American students were a little bit earlier. And this personally squared with Wang's experience of growing up in China, where she said that the cultural norm was that there was less emphasis on stories of early childhood memories. And she gives a quote to the BBC saying, "If society is telling you those memories are important to you, you'll hold on to them." And this also relates to cross-cultural studies saying that some of the examples of the people with, on average, the earliest childhood memories tend to be people of the Maori culture. And these same studies find that Maori families tend to place a lot of emphasis on elaborate narrative storytelling in the past. So I thought this was interesting that this could connect to some of the differences we've already read about and I think talked about in the first episode about cross-cultural differences in the age of the earliest memories and also gender differences, because there have been some studies showing that girls tend to have slightly earlier memories on average than boys, and that girls in childhood tend to relate stories in a more contexted and evaluative manner. But whatever the particulars of how it works, it's certainly not hard for me to imagine that the storytelling environment in which you grow up plays a large role on what and how you remember things from your earliest childhood.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And something also just to keep in mind, too, that I remember one of the sources I quoted in maybe the first episode mentioned, and that is that there's no right or wrong way, like right. Earlier memories of childhood versus later memories. Neither one is healthier or more correct. The brain remembers what it needs to remember.
Right. And well, playing on that, one way to interpret these findings, if they are correct, is that maybe by inhabiting an environment where there is a lot of elaborate narrative storytelling that involves a lot of, a contexting of events and including evaluations, that is an environment that tells a child that they need to remember things in that manner and thus makes them easier to retrieve and relate later on. Mm-hmm. Of course, the interesting thing being that, again, this is all coming back to autobiographical memories, the kind of memories for like events in your life that like you can later retell as stories. And this doesn't necessarily correspond to other types of memory, like, say, memory of how to do something, you know, memories that we often think of not as, quote, memory, but as learning.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so the language-based memory development idea has been around for a long time, and it has its proponents, though I think also it has its critics, and I don't think we should place too much emphasis on things like the role of language, because one big reason here is that some analogs to infantile amnesia have been discovered in animals like rats. So there are rat experiments showing kind of similar patterns of forgetting of the earliest experiences as rats age into adulthood. Rats, of course, never acquire language, but show some similar patterns. So it's clear that language is not the deciding factor, but may play a role in, say, the timing of different stages of memory acquisition. Another older idea that might still have something to do with the with childhood amnesia. What about the role of what researchers have called the cognitive self? I was reading about this in a paper called On Resolving the Enigma of Infantile Amnesia by Mark Howe and Mary Courage, published in Psychological Bulletin in 1993. And they discuss the idea of what if the crucial factor in the establishment of lasting autobiographical memories is the development of the concept of I and me, related in a way to the concept of theory of mind, understanding that your mind is different from the minds of others, that you know things other people don't know and have thoughts and feelings other people don't have, and that they likewise know things and have thoughts and feelings that you cannot share in unless they tell you. Under this proposal, it's not until we have mastered the concept of a self different from others that we're able to organize our memories into a sensical form that can be retrieved across time. Howe and Courage write in their conclusion, quote, "A series of significant developmental events take place when infants are between 18 and 30 months of age that prepare them to talk about personally experienced events. First, at about 18 months of age, infants learn to recognize their features in the mirror. The next acquisition is a more advanced representation of the self reflected in the pronominal reference to the self as I and me in the early months of the second year. Finally, the child learns to talk about immediate and then more distant past events in narrative, the language of autobiographical memory. Both narrative and autobiographical memory continue to develop in structure, organization, and content over the preschool years, but by that time, infantile amnesia is indeed a phenomenon of the past." And so this one's a little bit different because this one does not depend, while it's related to language, their idea of the concept of the cognitive self does not rely entirely on language. And they think there are ways that the cognitive self can be demonstrated before a child acquires the words in which to express it. But they think that the child needs a concept of self and I separate from the world and the events in the world in order to put the memories into a form that can later be accessed and expressed.
Yeah. I mean, again, because it sounds like without that, there's no like weight. There's no structure. It's just like memories of potentially of just environments and groups of people without the actual connection of like this, this is a value because I am at the center of it.
That's right. And that would connect again to the ideas about narrative and maybe the important role of, say, evaluative statements about memories, helping us to be able to recall them later.
Yeah. The child is. Yeah. The child is like, it's nice, but what is in it for me?
Yeah.
Why don't I remember it?
So in the end, when I'm looking at all these explanations, I don't know, of course, I'm, you know, I'm not a neuroscientist or a developmental psychologist, so I don't pretend to be expressing expertise on this. But I just say personally, I feel pretty convinced by the neurodevelopmental arguments, the ones about the development of the hippocampal memory system, that there's clearly some kind of like structural change going on in the brain in the early years of life. And this this plays a major role in why we don't retain all these memories until later life. As far as these explanations based in language and the cognitive self and stuff, I don't know. It seems like the evidence for them is a little bit softer, but I'm very interested in them and they seem plausible to me at least.
Mm, yeah.
But basically all the papers I read on this subject are, you know, the old cliche, they're calling for more research. They're like, you know, widely acknowledging this is not a settled question. And so, you know, we have some interesting ideas, but ultimately we don't know for sure why childhood amnesia happens, and maybe more research could help settle it.
Now, we've discussed false memories a good bit in these episodes, you know, talking about very early childhood memories that are to some degree falsified, unaugmented. You know, I think it's easy to mostly focus on the potential pitfalls of false memories or to land somewhere on sort of like the neutral impact that they may have. But I also wanted to tackle the question of just like, why is it also advantageous to have false memories? Like, why would this at all be adaptive? Is there an upside to this mental ability, or is this all just kind of junk? Is this just kind of a byproduct of the way that our brains have developed?
Well, I would say that this is not the only way in which our brains consistently generate false beliefs. And I think when our brains do that, they're usually doing it for a reason.
Yeah. And certainly this ties into larger issues of how we falsify beliefs, how we falsify memories, how we obsess over perhaps impractical ideas of what the future might hold. You know, I'm reminded of a couple of quotes here. I believe it was Alan Robb-Grillet who commented that, or he may have been quoting somebody else actually, that that repetition and recollection are the same force, but in different directions. I remember too. I think R. Scott Baker commenting that that like science fiction and fantasy kind of both fulfill the same purpose, but going either into the past or into the future, sort of constructing an unrealistic but far-fetched version of the future based on where we are now, and then the other is a version of the past that is equally fantastic and illogical and obviously not true, but telling about where we are in the present. Mm. So, you know, we're these strange creatures that that see ourselves as occupying this space, this now, and remembering what came before, predicting what is about to come. And then it's kind of open to discussion if there is actually a now point. Like, are we actually there, or is that also a construction of the past? Mm. But at any rate, I wanted to see what experts were saying about this. So I was reading a paper titled False Memories, What the Hell Are They For? By Aaron J. Newman and D. Stephen Lindsay, published in Applied Cognitive Psychology back in 2009. And I thought the authors made some good points here. A number of these are going to be things that, you know, we've discussed on the show before, or are, I guess, generally understood about memory and the brain. But first of all, this is all part of our mental time travel abilities that enable us to experience our memories of the past with a feeling of subjective clarity, while also enabling us to produce mental models of potential futures. Quote, recalling an autobiographical experience involves piecing together activated memorial information while at the same time making inferences based on other information available to us. Biases, stereotypes, and expectations that act on our current thinking also act on inferences that we make about mental events arising from the past. So obviously, given this system, failures are inevitable. Memory failures are inevitable. False memories, along with inaccurate or unlikely ruminated scenarios of the future, this is all just part of living with our human understanding of reality. And so various methods can be used and have been studied to produce false memories of events, the authors point out. These include suggestion via imagination exercises, the use of photographs, dream interpretation, guided imagery, and paraphrasing. I mean, even this, kind of joking example that we busted out earlier of you bringing up a hypothetical, entirely made up memory of childhood about crabs and it was so loaded with crabs. It's a relatively easy exercise for one to then turn that back on the person who created it and saying, well, is that completely made up? What does that say about you? Why did you bring up the crab so many times? You know, and you can begin to build on that.
Well, yes. And if you took that same story and said, hey, your parents told us this story about when you went to the beach when you were little. Do you remember this? Well, you might not necessarily at first, or you might think, well, maybe I do. And then over time, that could very easily turn into what feels like a real memory for you.
Yeah. And it also, now there are a number of factors to keep in mind too. It's worth noting that the results in experiments involving the creation or the fostering of false recollections, it depends on the degree to which a memory is falsified. For example, in many of these experiments, you'll find examples where they'll find out about an actual childhood memory. Like they would, in this case, say, talk to one of your parents and ask about your earliest beach encounter. And then use that in the construction of a false memory. Mm-hmm. And then you also have to take into account the weight of the memory that is being built up or augmented. So it's one thing, for example, for me to suggest, yeah, maybe you were really fascinated by crabs like you were in this false story of childhood. It's another to say, maybe that they had a, you were profoundly frightened by the crabs and this is like totally shaped who you are. You know, it's like how much weight are you putting on the memory? Mm-hmm. But for instance, one study referenced in this paper had high results of memory inception when you were trying to get them to remember a childhood prank. Now, mm-hmm. Nothing too severe, but, something that where it's not going to like shake the core of their being or really mess around too many understandings of self. It's just like, let's generate this memory of this prank that probably didn't actually occur.
Yeah. So if I'm understanding right, this might imply it's easier to generate a false memory for an event that is not really like, does not shake the core of your, how you would characterize your childhood, but rather for a kind of like weird, quirky, funny little event that doesn't really change anything about your life.
Right. And of course, a lot of the very sorts of memories, early childhood memories that we've been discussing here, the kind that are sort of shared among family, are exactly the sort of memory. You know, they're not necessarily profound or anything. They're amusing. They're fun. And therefore, it's easy to grab onto it. Now, the authors also point out that social factors such as group membership in the media as well can seemingly influence memories like this as well. Quote, socially driven distortions in memory. These may have several benefits for the individual, such as improving social relationships within a group, or they may improve social group coherence. So false memories can be self-enhancing in many ways, but they can also be group-enhancing. And in this, we're speaking broadly beyond merely like childhood memories, but even getting into things where, say, you were a part of a group, you join a group where memories of, say, even paranormal experiences have value. They bring you closer to the people in a group, or they enhance the overall connectivity of the group.
This is exactly what I was going to hypothesize earlier when you were talking. So I brought up, there are other ways that our brain consistently produces false beliefs. Mm-hmm. And you would suspect that there's probably an adaptive reason for doing that. Like there's survival benefit. That's why our brains work that way. And my guess was going to be social function, that the same way that, we can have not false memories, but false beliefs about the external world. These can easily be induced through a concept known as identity protective cognition. Mm-hmm. You know, people will reason in ways that are not strictly logical and will come to conclusions that they would find to be false if they were disinterested in the issue. But there is some social identity reason for coming to that belief. You know, in order to fit in with my social group, I need to be the kind of person that believes X. So I do believe X, and it is right. And I think the same could easily be true of memories. It probably matters more for your survival that you're getting along good with your group than that, like, you actually remembered what happened last Tuesday a year ago correctly. So if there's a way to remember that event incorrectly, but that would be sort of like fun to share as a group together, to tell that story and all bond and all feel good about each other, well, then maybe you'll go that way.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, all this makes sense, I think, because, of course, humans are highly social creatures. We've talked about this before. This has had an enormous impact on the human animal. So is it any surprise that we help each other remember events of our past? Is it any surprise that these memories may be distorted for the betterment of one's own integration with a group or the overall coherence of the group? Because for the social animal, the group is not just nice to have. Like, the group is survival. Being able to bond with the group has a real adaptive advantage, and being able to fit in, even if you're distorting the actual occurrence of events in the past, this may frequently outweigh the value of objective reality.
So it's better if all your friends are laughing about, hey, remember that time Johnny, I don't know, yeah, chase me with a steamed crab, and you don't really remember that, it's probably better for your brain to convince you you do remember that so you can laugh along with everybody else than to say, like, no, I don't think that happened.
Yeah. But again, these are generalizations. So, you know, individual experience is gonna differ, and there are all sorts of caveats that can come into play. But yeah, I think this is fascinating to think about.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Cowie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybutton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, in I think both of the last couple of episodes, we talked a little bit about myth babies and legendary babies of history, child Hercules, child Jesus, child Krishna, and so forth. So I do have just a little bit more on this, getting into the idea of the child hero and the child saint.
Okay, we're going to do another super baby sidebar here.
Yeah, and this one is going to end up bringing up child mortality again. So my apologies. It was not my intent to discuss this more, but in just diving into the topic, it like becomes an essential part of understanding some of these traditions.
Okay.
So, first of all, just talking about infant heroes in Greek tradition. One paper I was looking at here was Baby and Child Heroes in Ancient Greece by Karine Ondina Pash. And when it comes to the child hero proper, and not merely the infant form of an adult hero, so not just merely baby Hercules, but like a child hero that is a hero in and of itself, they're defined not by their actions and exploits, as with adult heroes, but by their untimely deaths, which immortalize them as in hero cults. And these include such examples as the children of Medea and the children of Heracles.
Mm.
To quote Pash here, quote, "From parental fears and sense of guilt arise the stories, songs, and sanctuaries honoring child heroes. Both myth and ritual articulate these very basic human anxieties, yet the emphasis is ultimately on the beauty that transcends the gruesomeness of these narratives and transforms dread into poetry." I think this is also interesting to consider when you look at the long list of child saints in the Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. And these include both martyred children and adults, as well as children who died at a young age, but were said to have been very mature, very holy, in their young life, in a way that it's almost like they were too holy for this world and therefore could not remain here. So just a couple of examples to illustrate both of these categories. There's Saint Romuald of Buckingham from the year 662, said to have lived only for 3 days, but the child was said to be able to speak and profess his faith right away. In fact, it, according to the legend, requested his own baptism and even delivered a sermon.
He requested it, but did he get it? Did they baptize him?
Yeah, I believe that's part of the story. Okay. He got the baptism and then got to deliver a sermon, which, you know, is a comical image in some ways. But also you understand where the creative energy of this comes from, like the idea of like a child and the attachment we feel to a child, the perfection and yet imperfection of a child. And then if there is and then when you factor in these various faith models of how salvation is supposed to work, if you factor in just the trauma of losing a young child, you can see where stories like this could be created.
Mm.
And then, of course, you also have examples of martyrs. There's Sicarius of Bethlehem, said to have been killed in King Herod's massacre of the innocents somewhere between 7 and 2 BCE. The alleged remains of the child are still held as holy relics today. So in these cases, you know, the child is not, my understanding, at least in this case, and this may vary from telling to telling, a case where the child itself is not said to have been holy or done anything holy, but was victim of some, or allegedly the victim of some sort of a heinous act.
Yeah, I'd lean on allegedly on that one, because I think the story of the slaughter of the innocents, from what I recall, is largely considered to be legendary.
Yeah, and of course it's very notable that some of the more notorious examples of child martyrs were utilized in cases of blood libel against Jewish communities. Hugh of Lincoln in the 13th century and Simon Trent in the 15th century being two prime examples. And these are sadly not the only examples you can pull out. Cases where the alleged murder of a child was then used as an excuse for acts of violence against communities that were blamed with that to death. So obviously kind of a depressing place I know to wind up in this tangent. And I didn't really want to discuss dead children again, but I guess it's unavoidable. You know, why does a child stand out in a mythic narrative? It may be about who that child will become, but there's also a weight to the child that does not pass on into mythic adulthood. And it can be clearly be leveraged in different ways as a rallying cry of martyrdom, as an inspiration of innocence, as an inspiration for violence and horror. It can be the kind of narrative that can circumvent the cruelty of the world or inspire more cruelty. You can go in various directions with it. Now, one final thing I wanted to discuss here a little bit, and I think we alluded to it a little bit earlier in this episode, is that, you know, as we've discussed already, there are numerous examples of suggested, falsified memories to turn to, including memories of various paranormal encounters, different forms of abuse, and indeed, we can also throw supposed memories of past lives into the mix. You know, you can certainly find people who claim to remember very early childhood, people who claim to remember their birth, but also people who claim to remember a time before their birth, before they were born, either in the womb or before the womb, in another life before the womb. And, you know, so, you know, it's this again speaks to the power of our ability to create and falsify meaningful memories. And it's not too big of a leap, right? If you can already create a memory of a thing that didn't occur, it's not too much of a leap to remember supposed lives before this one as well.
Right.
And there a lot of individuals have written on this and theorized on this sort of thing. Czech psychiatrist Stanislav Grof theorized that some near-death experiences are actually a kind of channeling of birth memories with the so-called tunnel of light representing the birth canal.
This, of course, skeptical about that.
Yes, this is, you know, very, everyone has a right to be very skeptical of this. I've seen it refuted by skeptics on a number of grounds, including that the experience of being born would not look like this, even if your infant head were in the right position and your eyes were actually open. And again, you were capable of forming memories like this. So I think there's very strong reasons to be skeptical of this being an actual memory. But like we've said, you get in there and you start tinkering with your memories, start recalling them, you start bringing in content, from different communities and learned individuals. You can start augmenting things. You can start falsifying things. And what you end up with can still be highly meaningful. It can still, to you, it can also have an impact on the creation of art and literature. If the name Stanislav Grof sounds familiar, longtime listeners might remember it coming up in an episode that Christian and I did on the art of H.R. Giger, because these very metaphors, you know, the tunnel of light, near death and pre-birth, these were explored in some of Giger's artwork. And Grof actually authored a 2018 book of Giger's work titled H.R. Giger and the Zeitgeist of the 20th Century. Grof, by the way, was also a technical advisor on Douglas Trumbull's 1983 film Brainstorm that had Christopher Walken in it, I believe. So again, not to say that, you know, these can't be potent ideas, but they do seem to stand outside of science. They're, these are more, we're getting more into the area of religion and myth and even the paranormal. But I think it all speaks to just how invested we can become in the story of us and those vast blank spaces in our recollection, as well as any glimmers that we might sense in the dark that we could then augment and accentuate into something else, something that is meaningful to us or makes us feel part of a group, etc. And, there are examples of this line of thinking from outside of science, concepts of pre-existence in various cultures. There's the concept of reincarnation or the transmigration of the soul. And we see this in various traditions, Greek traditions, early Jainism, Buddhism, Hinduism, medieval Jewish mysticism, new religious movements, and so many more examples.
There were some early Christians who believed in reincarnation.
Yeah. I was reading a little bit about this, the idea of a pre-mortal existence of the soul. various strains of thought concerning the not only the idea that the human soul had a pre-existence, that it was, say, created before the physical creation of the universe, and I guess, you know, the souls are just sitting around waiting to be installed in a physical form. And then there is also a fair amount of thought about the idea of the pre-existence of Jesus Christ, the idea that, yes, God is going to take on this sort of mortal incarnation because he has to go to earth and die for everyone's sins and so forth. But then there are some lines of thought that are like, okay, well, what was he doing before then? And I guess on one hand, you could say, well, God had not incarnated yet. So it's like he hadn't budded off into a physical form. But then there are these other lines of thought. It's like, oh, yeah, no, he's there. He's just sitting around waiting, but he just hasn't gone to earth yet. For example, I was reading that there was one early Christian theologian, I believe this is Origen of Alexandria, who lived at 185 through 253, taught that human souls existed before creation. And this was something that he would later be accused of heresy for. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the big take home from all of this is that we have an impressive ability to create meaningful memories out of various sources that are not pure recollection, to the limited extent that there is pure recollection of anything. And I guess I don't think there's anything intrinsically wrong with fostering memories of infancy, birth, or life before birth, so long as it improves one's quality of life and it doesn't take anything away from you or others. If that's the case, then what's the harm in it?
I think the way I'd put my feeling is reminisce and enjoy your memories, but also be aware of the fact that some of them may not have a factual basis.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was thinking about this, I was trying to think, well, how could it be harmful? And I think that the main sticking point that I could come up with is if one's claims of false memories could embolden harmful models in others. So this is just a purely hypothetical scenario, but imagine that you, through one method or another that we've discussed here, fostered memory of alien abduction that for you is awe-inspiring and beneficial. Like, I remember seeing aliens when I was a child. And isn't that great? This is my brain-expanding, cosmos-appreciating moment. But what if your pronounced belief in these experiences enables someone else to further engage in a harmful variation on it? Or on the other hand, what if, here's another scenario, what if your harmless accounts of a past life embolden someone else to and then wind up in a situation where they're being manipulated or conned by someone who is taking advantage of this, you know, longing for or recollection of a past life.
Telling you this stuff is real and I can find your past selves for you for a price.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of gray area in any scenario like that. But, hypothetical. But, it's worth considering, I think, that in any given paranormal area, it's going to be dependent on more than just mere professed experience and or augmented or false memories. There may also be disingenuous actors involved, manipulators of disinformation, and of course, just outright con artists as well. So I don't know. Food for thought.
I'd reiterate what I said. I mean, you can enjoy all your family memories and all the, you know, all the good stuff, but also just be realistic about the fallibility of memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
If there were a video camera present, it may not actually have happened the way you remember it. But,
right.
You know, that our memory is all we've got.
Yeah.
Or in many cases, it's all we got. I guess sometimes you did have a video camera there.
Yeah, yeah. You have the video and you have the photographs, which then can, of course, be used to falsify memories.
Yeah.
So, of course, with advances in technology, things are you're only going to get more complicated on those grounds. All right, we're going to go ahead and close out this I guess trilogy of episodes here. But we'd continue to love to hear from everyone out there. If you have thoughts on early childhood memories, you want to share early childhood memories, memories of past lives, anything that falls under the heading of the topic here, write in. We would love to listen to you and discuss any of this potentially on future episodes of Listener Mail. Listener Mail is published on Mondays. On Wednesdays, we do short form artifact or monster fact episodes, core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And on Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film.
Huge thanks to our audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.